Chapter 47. Outside in the piazza, amid the chaos of arriving police, a middle-aged man stood in the shadows of the Loggia dei Lanzi, where he had been observing the activity with great interest. The man wore plume Paris spectacles, a paisley necktie, and a tiny gold stud in one ear. As he watched the commotion, he caught himself scratching at his neck again. The man had developed a rash overnight, which seemed to be getting worse, manifesting in small pustules on his jawline, neck, cheeks, and over his eyes. When he glanced down at his fingernails, he saw they were bloody. He took out his handkerchief and wiped his fingers, also dabbing the bloody pustules on his neck and cheeks. When he had cleaned himself up, he returned his gaze to the two black vans parked outside the palazzo. The closest van contained two people in the back seat. One was an armed soldier in black. The other was an older but very beautiful silver-haired woman, wearing a blue amulet. The soldier looked as if he were preparing a hypodermic syringe. Inside the van, Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky gazed absently out at the palazzo, wondering about how this crisis had deteriorated to such an extent. "Ma'am," a deep voice said beside her. She turned groggily to the soldier accompanying her. He was gripping her forearm and holding up a syringe. "Just be still." The sharp stab of a needle pierced her flesh. The soldier completed the injection. "Now go back to sleep." As she closed her eyes, she could have sworn she saw a man studying her from the shadows. He wore designer glasses and a preppy necktie. His face was rashy and red. For a moment she thought she knew him, but when she opened her eyes for another look, the man had disappeared. Chapter 48. In the darkness of the garret, Langdon and Sienna were now separated by a 20-foot expanse of open air. 8 feet beneath them, the fallen plank had come to rest across the wooden framing that supported the canvas bearing Vasari's apotheosis. The large flashlight, still glowing, was resting on the canvas itself, creating a small indentation like a stone on a trampoline.
"The plank behind you," Langdon whispered. "Can you drag it across to reach this strut?"
Sienna eyed the plank.
"Not without the other end falling into the canvas."
Langdon had feared as much. The last thing they needed now was to send a 2x6 crashing through a Vasari canvas.
"I've got an idea," Sienna said,
now moving sideways along the strut, heading for the side wall. Langdon followed on his beam, the footing becoming more treacherous with each step as they ventured away from the flashlight beam. By the time they reached the sidewall, they were almost entirely in darkness.
"Down there," Sienna whispered,
pointing into the obscurity below them.
"At the edge of the frame. It's got to be mounted to the wall. It should hold me."
Before Langdon could protest, Sienna was climbing down off the strut, using a series of supporting beams as a ladder. She eased herself down onto the edge of the wooden lacuna. It creaked once, but held. Then, inching along the wall, Sienna began moving in Langdon's direction, as if she were inching across the ledge of a high building. The lacuna creaked again.
"Thin ice," Langdon thought. "Stay near shore."
As Sienna reached the halfway point, approaching the strut on which he stood in the darkness, Langdon felt a sudden renewed hope that they might indeed get out of here in time. Suddenly, somewhere in the darkness ahead, a door slammed, and he heard fast-moving footsteps approaching along the walkway. The beam of a flashlight now appeared, sweeping the area, getting closer every second. Langdon felt his hopes sink. Someone was coming their way, moving along the main walkway and cutting off their escape route.
"Sienna, keep going," he whispered,
reacting on instinct.
"Continue the entire length of the wall. There's an exit at the far end. I'll run interference."
"No,"
Sienna whispered urgently. "Robert, come back."
But Langdon was already on the move, heading back along the strut toward the central spine of the garret, leaving Sienna in the darkness, inching across the side wall, 8 feet below him. When Langdon arrived at the center of the garret, a faceless silhouette with a flashlight had just arrived on the raised viewing platform. The person halted at the low guardrail, and aimed the flashlight beam down into Langdon's eyes. The glare was blinding, and Langdon immediately raised his arms in surrender. He could not have felt more vulnerable, balanced high above the hull of the 500, blinded by a bright light. Langdon waited for a gunshot or for an authoritative command, but there was only silence. After a moment, the beam swung away from his face and began probing the darkness behind him, apparently looking for something or someone else. As the beam left his eyes, Langdon could just make out the silhouette of the person now blocking his escape route. It was a woman, lean and dressed all in black. He had no doubt that beneath her baseball cap was a head of spiked hair. Langdon's muscles tightened instinctively as his mind flooded with images of Dr. Marconi dying on the hospital floor. "She found me. She's here to finish the job." Langdon flashed on an image of Greek freedivers swimming deep into a tunnel, far past the point of no return, and then colliding with a stony dead end. The assassin swung her flashlight beam back down into Langdon's eyes.
"Mr. Langdon," she whispered, "where is your friend?"
Langdon felt a chill. This killer is here for both of us. Langdon made a show of glancing away from Sienna, over his shoulder into the darkness from which they'd come. "She has nothing to do with this. You want me." Langdon prayed that Sienna was now making progress along the wall. If she could sneak beyond the viewing platform, she could then quietly cross back to the central boardwalk behind the spike-haired woman and move toward the door. The assassin again raised her light and scanned the empty garret behind him. With the glare momentarily out of his eyes, Langdon caught a sudden glimpse of a form in the darkness behind her. Oh, God, no. Sienna was indeed making her way across a strut in the direction of the central boardwalk, but unfortunately, she was only 10 yards behind their attacker.
"Sienna, no! You're too close. She'll hear you."
The beam returned to Langdon's eyes again.
"Listen carefully, Professor," the assassin whispered. "If you want to live, I suggest you trust me. My mission has been terminated. I have no reason to harm you. You and I are on the same team now, and I may know how to help you."
Langdon was barely listening, his thoughts focused squarely on Sienna, who was now faintly visible in profile, climbing deftly up onto the walkway behind the viewing platform, entirely too close to the woman with the gun.
"Run!" he willed her. "Get the hell out of here!"
Sienna, however, to Langdon's alarm, held her ground, crouching low in the shadows, and watching in silence. Vianta's eyes probed the darkness behind Langdon.
"Where the hell did she go? Did they separate?"
Vianta had to find a way to keep the fleeing couple out of Bruder's hands.
"It's my only hope." "Sienna,"
Vianta ventured in a throaty whisper,
"if you can hear me, listen carefully. You do not want to be captured by the men downstairs. They will not be lenient. I know an escape route. I can help you. Trust me."
"Trust you?" Langdon challenged, his voice suddenly loud enough that anyone nearby could hear him. "You're a killer."
"Sienna is nearby," Vianta realized. "Langdon is talking to her, trying to warn her."
Vianta tried again.
"Sienna, the situation is complicated, but I can get you out of here. Consider your options. You're trapped. You have no choice."
"She has a choice," Langdon called out loudly, "and she's smart enough to run as far from you as possible."
"Everything's changed," Vianta insisted. "I have no reason to hurt either of you.
You killed Dr. Marconi, and I'm guessing you're also the one who shot me in the head."
Vianta knew that the man was never going to believe she had no intention of killing him.
"The time for talking is over. There's nothing I can say to convince him."
Without hesitation, she reached into her leather jacket and extracted the silenced handgun. Motionless in the shadows, Sienna remained crouched on the walkway no more than 10 yards behind the woman who had just confronted Langdon. Even in the dark, the woman's silhouette was unmistakable, To Sienna's horror, she was brandishing the same weapon she had used on Dr. Marconi.
She's going to fire,
Sienna knew, sensing the woman's body language. Sure enough, the woman took two threatening steps toward Langdon, stopping at the low railing that enclosed the viewing platform above Vasari's apotheosis. The assassin was now as close to Langdon as she could get. She raised the gun and pointed it directly at Langdon's chest.
This will only hurt for an instant, she said. But it's my only choice.
Sienna reacted on instinct. The unexpected vibration in the boards beneath Vianta's feet was just enough to cause her to turn slightly as she was firing. Even as her weapon discharged, she knew it was no longer pointed at Langdon. Something was approaching behind her, approaching fast. Vianta spun in place, swinging her weapon 180 degrees toward her attacker, and a flash of blonde hair glinted in the darkness as someone collided with Vianta at full speed. The gun hissed again, but the person had crouched below barrel level in order to apply a forceful upward body check. Vianta's feet left the floor, and her midsection crashed hard into the low railing of the viewing platform. As her torso was propelled out over the railing, she flailed her arms, trying to grab onto anything to stop her fall. But it was too late. She went over the edge. Vianta fell through the darkness, bracing herself for the collision with the dusty floor that lay 8 feet beneath the platform. Strangely, though, her landing was softer than she'd imagined, as if she had been caught by a cloth hammock, which now sagged beneath her weight. Disoriented, Vianta lay on her back and stared up at her attacker. Sienna Brooks was looking down at her over the railing. Stunned, Vianta opened her mouth to speak. But suddenly, just beneath her, there was a loud, ripping sound. The cloth that was supporting her weight tore open. Vianta was falling again. This time she fell for 3 very long seconds, during which she found herself staring upward at a ceiling that was covered with beautiful paintings. The painting directly above her, a massive circular canvas depicting Cosimo I encircled by cherubs on a heavenly cloud, now showed a jagged, dark tear that cut through its center. Then, with a sudden crash, Vianta's entire world vanished into blackness. High above, frozen in disbelief, Robert Langdon peered through the torn apotheosis into the cavernous space below. On the stone floor of the Hall of the 500, the spike-haired woman lay motionless, a dark pool of blood quickly spreading from her head. She still had the gun clutched in her hand. Langdon raised his eyes to Sienna, who was also staring down, transfixed by the grim scene below. Sienna's expression was one of utter shock.
I didn't mean to.
You reacted on instinct, Langdon whispered. She was about to kill me.
From down below, shouts of alarm filtered up through the torn canvas. Gently, Langdon guided Sienna away from the railing.
We need to keep moving.
Chapter 49. In the secret study of Duchess Bianca Capello, Agent Bruder had heard a sickening thud followed by a growing commotion in the Hall of the 500. He rushed to the grate in the wall and peered through it. The scene on the elegant stone floor below took him several seconds to process. The pregnant museum administrator had arrived beside him at the grate, immediately covering her mouth in mute terror at the sight below, a crumpled figure surrounded by panicked tourists. As the woman's gaze shifted slowly upward to the ceiling of the Hall of the 500, she let out a pained whimper. Bruder looked up, following her gaze to a circular ceiling panel, a painted canvas with a large tear across the center. He turned to the woman.
How do we get up there?
At the other end of the building, Langdon and Sienna descended breathlessly from the attic and burst through a doorway. Within a matter of seconds, Langdon had found the small alcove, deftly hidden behind a crimson curtain. He had recalled it clearly from his secret passages tour.
The Duke of Athens' stairway,
The sound of running footsteps and shouting seemed to be coming from all directions now, and Langdon knew their time was short. He pulled aside the curtain, and he and Sienna slipped through onto a small landing. Without a word, they began to descend the stone staircase. The passage had been designed as a series of frighteningly narrow switchback stairs. The deeper they went, the tighter it seemed to get. Just as Langdon felt as if the walls were moving in to crush him, thankfully, they could go no farther. Ground level. The space at the bottom of the stairs was a tiny stone chamber, and although its exit had to be one of the smallest doors on Earth, it was a welcome sight. Only about 4 feet high, the door was made of heavy wood with iron rivets and a heavy interior bolt to keep people out.
"I can hear street sounds beyond the door," Sienna whispered, still looking shaken. "What's on the other side?"
"The Via della Nina,"
Langdon replied, picturing the crowded pedestrian walkway.
"But there may be police."
"They won't recognize us. They'll be looking for a blonde girl and a dark-haired man."
Langdon eyed her strangely.
"Which is precisely what we are."
Sienna shook her head, a melancholy resolve crossing her face.
"I didn't want you to see me like this, Robert. But unfortunately, it's what I look like at the moment."
Abruptly, Sienna reached up and grabbed a handful of her blonde hair. Then she yanked down, and all of her hair slid off in a single motion. Langdon recoiled, startled both by the fact that Sienna wore a wig and by her altered appearance without it. Sienna Brooks was, in fact, totally bald, her bare scalp smooth and pale, like a cancer patient undergoing chemotherapy.
"On top of it all, she's ill?"
"I know," she said. "Long story. Now, bend down."
She held up the wig, clearly intending to put it on Langdon's head.
"Is she serious?"
Langdon half-heartedly bent over, and Sienna wedged the blonde hair onto his head. The wig barely fit, but she arranged it as best as she could. Then she stepped back and assessed him. Not quite satisfied, she reached up, loosened his tie, and slipped the loop up onto his forehead, retightening it like a bandana and securing the ill-fitting wig to his head. Sienna now set to work on herself, rolling up her pant legs and pushing her socks down around her ankles. When she stood up, she had a sneer on her lips. The lovely Sienna Brooks was now a punk rock skinhead. The former Shakespearean actress's transformation was startling.
"Remember," she said, 90% of personal recognition is body language. So when you move, move like an aging rocker."
"Aging I can do," Langdon thought. "Rocker? I'm not so sure."
Before Langdon could argue the point, Sienna had unbolted the tiny door and swung it open. She ducked low and exited onto the crowded cobblestone street. Langdon followed, nearly on all fours as he emerged into the daylight. Aside from a few startled glances at the mismatched couple emerging from the tiny door in the foundation of Palazzo Vecchio, nobody gave them a second look. Within seconds, Langdon and Sienna were moving east, swallowed up by the crowd. The man in the plume Paris eyeglasses picked at his bleeding skin as he snaked through the crowd, keeping a safe distance behind Robert Langdon and Sienna Brooks. Despite their clever disguises, he had spotted them emerging from the tiny door on the Via della Nina, and had immediately known who they were. He had tailed them only a few blocks before he got winded, his chest aching acutely, forcing him to take shallow breaths. He felt like he'd been punched in the sternum. Gritting his teeth against the pain, he forced his attention back to Langdon and Sienna as he continued to follow them through the streets of Florence. Chapter 50. The morning sun had fully risen now, casting long shadows down the narrow canyons that snaked between the buildings of old Florence. Shopkeepers had begun throwing open the metal grates that protected their shops and bars, and the air was heavy with the aromas of morning espresso and freshly baked cornetti. Despite annoying hunger, Langdon kept moving.
"I've got to find the mask.
and see what's hidden on the back. As Langdon led Sienna northward along the slender Via dei Leoni, he was having a hard time getting used to the sight of her bald head. Her radically altered appearance reminded him that he barely knew her. They were moving in the direction of Piazza del Duomo, the square where Ignazio Busoni had been found dead after placing his final phone call. "Robert," Ignazio had managed to say, breathless, "what you seek is safely hidden. The gates are open to you, but you must hurry. Paradise 25, Godspeed. Paradise 25, Langdon repeated to himself, still puzzled that Ignazio Busoni had recalled Dante's text well enough to reference a specific canto off the top of his head. Something about that canto was apparently memorable to Busoni. Whatever it was, Langdon knew he would find out soon enough, as soon as he laid his hands on a copy of the text, which he could easily do at any number of locations up ahead. His shoulder-length wig was beginning to itch now, and though he felt somewhat ridiculous in his disguise, he had to admit that Sienna's impromptu styling had been an effective ruse. Nobody had given them a second look, not even the police reinforcements who had just rushed past them en route to the Palazzo Vecchio. Sienna had been walking in total silence beside him for several minutes, and Langdon glanced over to make sure she was okay. She seemed miles away, probably trying to accept the fact that she'd just killed the woman who'd been chasing them. "Lyra for your thoughts?" he ventured lightly, hoping to pull her mind from the image of the spike-haired woman lying dead on the palazzo floor. Sienna emerged slowly from her contemplations.
"I was thinking of Zobrist," she said slowly, "trying to recall anything else I might know about him."
"And?" She shrugged.
"Most of what I know is from a controversial essay he wrote a few years ago. It really stayed with me. Among the medical community, it instantly went viral."
She winced.
"Sorry, bad choice of words."
Langdon gave a grim chuckle. "Go on."
"His essay essentially declared that the human race was on the brink of extinction, and that unless we had a catastrophic event that precipitously decreased global population growth, our species would not survive another 100 years.
Langdon turned and stared at her. "A single century?"
"It was a pretty stark thesis. The predicted time frame was substantially shorter than previous estimates, but it was supported by some very potent scientific data. He made a lot of enemies by declaring that all doctors should stop practicing medicine because extending the human lifespan was only exacerbating the population problem."
Langdon now understood why the article spread wildly through the medical community.
"Not surprisingly," Sienna continued, "Zobrist was immediately attacked from all sides. Politicians, clergy, the World Health Organization, all of whom derided him as a doomsayer lunatic who was simply trying to cause panic. They took particular umbrage at his statement that today's youth, if they chose to reproduce, would have offspring that literally would witness the end of the human race. Zobrist illustrated his point with a doomsday clock, which showed that if the entire span of human life on Earth were compressed into a single hour, we are now in its final seconds."
"I've actually seen that clock online," Langdon said.
"Yes, well, it's his, and it caused quite an uproar. The biggest backlash against Zobrist, however, came when he declared that his advances in genetic engineering would be far more helpful to mankind if they were used not to cure disease, but rather to create it."
"What?"
"Yes. He argued that his technology should be used to limit population growth by creating hybrid strains of disease that our modern medicine would be unable to cure."
Langdon felt a rising dread as his mind conjured images of strange hybrid designer viruses that, once released, were totally unstoppable.
"Over a few short years," Sienna said, "Zobrist went from being the toast of the medical world to being a total outcast, an anathema."
She paused, a look of compassion crossing her face.
"It's really no wonder he snapped and killed himself. Even sadder because his thesis is probably correct."
Langdon almost fell over. "I'm sorry? You think he's right?"
Sienna gave him a solemn shrug.
Robert, speaking from a purely scientific standpoint, all logic, no heart, I can tell you without a doubt that without some kind of drastic change, the end of our species is coming. And it's coming fast. It won't be fire, brimstone, apocalypse, or nuclear war. It will be total collapse due to the number of people on the planet. The mathematics is indisputable.
Langdon stiffened.
I've studied a fair amount of biology, she said, and it's quite normal for a species to go extinct simply as a result of overpopulating its environment. Picture a colony of surface algae living in a tiny pond in the forest, enjoying the pond's perfect balance of nutrients. Unchecked, they reproduce so wildly that they quickly cover the pond's entire surface, blotting out the sun, and thereby preventing the growth of the nutrients in the pond. Having sapped everything possible from their environment, the algae quickly die and disappear without a trace. She gave a heavy sigh.
A similar fate could easily await mankind, far sooner and faster than any of us imagine.
Langdon felt deeply unsettled. But that seems impossible.
Not impossible, Robert. Just unthinkable. The human mind has a primitive ego defense mechanism that negates all realities that produce too much stress for the brain to handle. It's called denial.
I've heard of denial, Langdon quipped blithely, but I don't think it exists. Sienna rolled her eyes.
Cute. But believe me, it's very real. Denial is a critical part of the human coping mechanism. Without it, we would all wake up terrified every morning about all the ways we could die. Instead, our mind blocks out our existential fears by focusing on stresses we can handle, like getting to work on time or paying our taxes. If we have wider existential fears, we jettison them very quickly, refocusing on simple tasks and daily trivialities.
Langdon recalled a recent web-tracking study of students at some Ivy League universities which revealed that even highly intellectual users displayed an instinctual tendency toward denial. According to the study, the vast majority of university students, after clicking on a depressing news article about Arctic ice melt or species extinction, would quickly exit that page in favor of something trivial that purged their minds of fear. Favorite choices included sports highlights, funny cat videos, and celebrity gossip. In ancient mythology, Langdon offered, a hero in denial is the ultimate manifestation of hubris and pride. No man is more prideful than he who believes himself immune to the dangers of the world. Dante clearly agreed, denouncing pride as the worst of the seven deadly sins, and punished the prideful in the deepest ring of the inferno. Sienna reflected a moment and then continued.
Zobrist's article accused many of the world's leaders of being in extreme denial, putting their heads in the sand. He was particularly critical of the World Health Organization.
I bet that went over well.
They reacted by equating him with a religious zealot on a street corner holding a sign that says the end is near.
Harvard Square has a couple of those.
Yes, and we all ignore them because none of us can imagine it will happen. But believe me, just because the human mind can't imagine something happening doesn't mean it won't.
You almost sound like you're a fan of Zobrists.
I'm a fan of the truth, she replied forcefully, even if it's painfully hard to accept.
Langdon fell silent, again feeling strangely isolated from Sienna at the moment, trying to understand her bizarre combination of passion and detachment. Sienna glanced over at him, her face softening.
Robert, look, I'm not saying Zobrist is correct, that a plague that kills half the world's people is the answer to overpopulation. Nor am I saying we should stop curing the sick. What I am saying is that our current path is a pretty simple formula for destruction. Population growth is an exponential progression occurring within a system of finite space and limited resources. The end will arrive very abruptly. Our experience will not be that of slowly running out of gas. It will be more like driving off a cliff.
Langdon exhaled, trying to process everything he had just heard.
Speaking of which,
she added, somberly pointing up in the air to their right,
I'm pretty sure that's where Zobrist jumped.
Langdon glanced up and saw that they were just passing the austere stone facade of the Bargello Museum to their right. Behind it, the tapered spire of the Badia Tower rose above the surrounding structures. He stared at the top of the tower, wondering why Zobrist had jumped, and hoped to hell it wasn't because the man had done something terrible and hadn't wanted to face what was coming.
"Critics of Zobrist," Sienna said, "like to point out how paradoxical it is that many of the genetic technologies he developed are now extending life expectancy dramatically."
"Which only compounds the population problem."
"Exactly. Zobrist once said publicly that he wished he could put the genie back in the bottle and erase some of his contributions to human longevity. I suppose that makes sense ideologically. The longer we live, the more our resources go to supporting the elderly and ailing."
Langdon nodded. "I've read that in the U.S. some 60% of health care costs go to support patients during the last 6 months of their lives."
"True. And while our brains say, this is insane, our hearts say, keep Grandma alive as long as we can."
Langdon nodded. "It's the conflict between Apollo and Dionysus, a famous dilemma in mythology. It's the age-old battle between mind and heart, which seldom want the same thing." The mythological reference, Langdon had heard, was now being used in AA meetings to describe the alcoholic who stares at a glass of alcohol, his brain knowing it will harm him, but his heart craving the comfort it will provide. The message apparently was, "Don't feel alone. Even the gods were conflicted."
"Who needs Agathusha?"
Sienna whispered suddenly. "I'm sorry?" Sienna glanced up.
"I finally remembered the name of Zobrist's essay. It was called, Who Needs Agathusha?"
Langdon had never heard the word Agathusha, but took his best guess based on its Greek roots, Agathos and Thusia. Agathusha would be a good sacrifice?
"Almost. Its actual meaning is a self-sacrifice for the common good."
She paused.
"Otherwise known as benevolent suicide."
Langdon had indeed heard this term before, once in relation to a bankrupt father who killed himself so his family could collect his life insurance, and a second time to describe a remorseful serial killer who ended his life fearing he couldn't control his impulse to kill. The most chilling example Langdon recalled, however, was in the 1967 novel Logan's Run, which depicted a future society in which everyone gladly agreed to commit suicide at age 21, thus fully enjoying their youth while not letting their numbers or old age stress the planet's limited resources. If Langdon recalled correctly, the movie version of Logan's Run had increased the termination age from 21 to 30, no doubt in an attempt to make the film more palatable to the box office's crucial 18 to 25 demographic. "So, Zobrist's essay," Langdon said. "I'm not sure I understand the title. Who needs Agathusha? Was he saying it sarcastically, as in, who needs benevolent suicide? We all do?"
"Actually, no. The title is a pun."
Langdon shook his head, not seeing it.
"Who needs suicide? As in the WHO, the World Health Organization?" In his essay, Zobrist railed against the director of the WHO, Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky, who has been there forever and, according to Zobrist, is not taking population control seriously. His article was saying that the WHO would be better off if Director Sinsky killed herself.
Compassionate guy.
The perils of being a genius, I guess. Oftentimes, those special brains, the ones that are capable of focusing more intently than others, do so at the expense of emotional maturity.
Langdon pictured the articles he had seen about the young Sienna, the child prodigy with the 208 IQ and off-the-chart intellectual function. Langdon wondered if, in talking about Zobrist, she was also, on some level, talking about herself. He also wondered how long she would choose to keep her secret. Up ahead, Langdon spotted the landmark he had been looking for. After crossing the Via dei Leoni, Langdon led her to the intersection of an exceptionally narrow street, more of an alleyway. The sign overhead read, Via Dante Alighieri. "It sounds like you know a lot about the human brain," Langdon said. "Was that your area of concentration in medical school?"
"No, but when I was a kid, I read a lot. I became interested in brain science because I had some
medical issues. Langdon shot her a curious look, hoping she would continue.
My brain, Sienna said quietly. It grew differently from most kids, and it caused some problems. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was wrong with me, and in the process I learned a lot about neuroscience.
She caught Langdon's eye.
And yes, my baldness is related to my medical condition.
Langdon averted his eyes. Embarrassed, he'd asked.
Don't worry about it, she said. I've learned to live with it.
As they moved into the cold air of the shadowed alleyway, Langdon considered everything he had just learned about Zobrist and his alarming philosophical positions. A recurring question nagged at him. These soldiers, Langdon began, the ones trying to kill us, who are they? It makes no sense. If Zobrist has put a potential plague out there, wouldn't everyone be on the same side, working to stop its release?
Not necessarily. Zobrist may be a pariah in the medical community, but he probably has a legion of devout fans of his ideology. People who agree that a culling is a necessary evil to save the planet. For all we know, these soldiers are trying to ensure that Zobrist's vision is realized.
Zobrist's own private army of disciples? Langdon considered the possibility. Admittedly, history was full of zealots and cults who killed themselves because of all kinds of crazy notions. A belief that their leader is the Messiah. A belief that a spaceship is waiting for them behind the moon. A belief that Judgment Day is imminent. The speculation about population control was at least grounded in science, and yet something about these soldiers still didn't feel right to Langdon. I just can't believe that a bunch of trained soldiers would knowingly agree to kill innocent masses, all the while fearing they might get sick and die themselves. Sienna shot him a puzzled look.
Robert, what do you think soldiers do when they go to war? They kill innocent people and risk their own death. Anything is possible when people believe in a cause.
A cause? Releasing a plague? Sienna glanced at him, her brown eyes probing.
Robert, the cause is not releasing a plague. It's saving the world.
She paused.
One of the passages in Bertrand Zobrist's essay that got a lot of people talking was a very pointed hypothetical question. I want you to answer it.
What's the question?
Zobrist asked the following. If you could throw a switch and randomly kill half the population on Earth, would you do it?
Of course not.
Okay. But what if you were told that if you didn't throw that switch right now, the human race would be extinct in the next 100 years?
She paused.
Would you throw it then, even if it meant you might murder friends, family, and possibly even yourself?
Sienna, I can't possibly...
It's a hypothetical question, she said. Would you kill half the population today in order to save our species from extinction?
Langdon felt deeply disturbed by the macabre subject they were discussing, and so he was grateful to see a familiar red banner hanging on the side of a stone building just ahead. Look, he announced, pointing. We're here. Sienna shook her head.
Like I said, denial.
Chapter 51. The Casa di Dante is located on the Via Santa Margherita and is easily identified by the large banner suspended from the stone facade partway up the alleyway. Museo, Casa di Dante. Sienna eyed the banner with uncertainty.
We're going to Dante's house?
Not exactly, Langdon said. Dante lived around the corner. This is more of a Dante museum. Langdon had ventured inside the place once, curious about the art collection, which turned out to be no more than reproductions of famous Dante-related works from around the world, and yet it was interesting to see them all gathered together under one roof. Sienna looked suddenly hopeful.
And you think they have an ancient copy of the Divine Comedy on display?
Langdon chuckled. No. But I know they have a gift shop that sells huge posters with the entire text of Dante's Divine Comedy printed in microscopic type. She gave him a slightly appalled glance. I know, but it's better than nothing. The only problem is that my eyes are going, so you'll have to read the fine print.
Eccusa,
an old man called out, seeing them approach the door.
E il giorno di riposo.
Closed for the Sabbath? Langdon felt suddenly disoriented again. He looked at Sienna. Isn't today Monday? She nodded.
Florentines prefer a Monday Sabbath.
Langdon groaned, suddenly recalling the city's unusual weekly calendar. Because tourist dollars flowed most heavily on weekends, many Florentine merchants chose to move the Christian day of rest from Sunday to Monday to prevent the Sabbath from cutting too deeply into their bottom line. Unfortunately, Langdon realized, this probably also ruled out his other option, the paperback exchange. One of Langdon's favorite Florentine bookshops, which would definitely have had copies of the Divine Comedy on hand.
Any other ideas? Sienna said.
Langdon thought a long moment and finally nodded. There's a site just around the corner where Dante enthusiasts gather. I bet someone there has a copy we can borrow.
It's probably closed too, Sienna warned. Almost every place in town moves the Sabbath away from Sunday.
This place wouldn't dream of doing such a thing, Langdon replied with a smile. It's a church. 50 yards behind them, lurking among the crowd, the man with the skin rash and gold earring leaned on a wall, savoring this chance to catch his breath. His breathing was not getting any better, and the rash on his face was nearly impossible to ignore, especially the sensitive skin just above his eyes. He took off his plume Paris glasses and gently rubbed his sleeve across his eye sockets, trying not to break the skin. When he replaced his glasses, he could see his quarry moving on. Forcing himself to follow, he continued after them, breathing as gently as possible. Several blocks behind Langdon and Sienna, inside the Hall of the 500, Agent Bruder stood over the broken body of the all-too-familiar spike-haired woman who was now lying sprawled out on the floor. He knelt down and retrieved her handgun, carefully removing the clip for safety before handing it off to one of his men. The pregnant museum administrator, Marta Alvarez, stood off to one side. She had just relayed to Bruder a brief but startling account of what had transpired with Robert Langdon since the previous night, including a single piece of information that Bruder was still trying to process.
Langdon claims to have amnesia.
Bruder pulled out his phone and dialed. The line at the other end rang 3 times before his boss answered, sounding distant and unsteady.
Yes, Agent Bruder, go ahead.
Bruder spoke slowly to ensure that his every word was understood.
We are still trying to locate Langdon and the girl, but there's been another development.
Bruder paused.
And if it's true, it changes everything.
The provost paced his office, fighting the temptation to pour himself another scotch, forcing himself to face this growing crisis head on. Never in his career had he betrayed a client or failed to keep an agreement, and he most certainly had no intention of starting now. At the same time, he suspected that he might have gotten himself tangled up in a scenario whose purpose diverged from what he had originally imagined. 1 year ago, the famous geneticist Bertrand Zobrist had come aboard the Mendacium and requested a safe haven in which to work. At that time, the provost imagined that Zobrist was planning to develop a secret medical procedure whose patenting would increase Zobrist's vast fortune. It would not be the first time the consortium had been hired by paranoid scientists and engineers who preferred working in extreme isolation to prevent their valuable ideas from being stolen. With that in mind, the provost accepted the client and was not surprised when he learned that the people at the World Health Organization had begun searching for him. Nor did he give it a second thought when the director of the WHO herself, Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky, seemed to make it her personal mission to locate their client.
The consortium has always faced powerful adversaries.
As agreed, the consortium carried out their agreement with Zobrist, no questions asked, thwarting Sinsky's efforts to find him for the entire length of the scientist's contract.
Almost the entire length.
Less than a week before the contract was to expire, Sinsky had somehow located Zobrist in Florence and moved in, harassing and chasing him until he committed suicide. For the first time in his career, the provost had failed to provide the protection he had agreed to, and it haunted him, along with the bizarre circumstances of Zobrist's death.
He committed suicide rather than being captured? What the hell was Zobrist protecting? In the aftermath of his death, Sinsky had confiscated an item from Zobrist's safe deposit box, and now the consortium was locked in a head-to-head battle with Sinsky in Florence, a high-stakes treasure hunt to find... To find what? The provost felt himself glance instinctively toward the bookshelf and the heavy tome given to him 2 weeks ago by the wild-eyed Zobrist. The Divine Comedy. The provost retrieved the book and carried it back to his desk, where he dropped it with a heavy thud. With unsteady fingers, he opened the cover to the first page and again read the inscription. My dear friend, thank you for helping me find the path. The world thanks you, too. First off, the provost thought, you and I were never friends. He read the inscription 3 more times. Then he turned his eyes to the bright red circle his client had scrawled on his calendar, highlighting tomorrow's date. The world thanks you? He turned and gazed out at the horizon a long moment. In the silence, he thought about the video and heard the voice of Facilitator Knowlton from his earlier phone call. I thought you might want to preview it before upload. The content is quite disturbing. The call still puzzled the provost. Knowlton was one of his best facilitators, and making such a request was entirely out of character. He knew better than to suggest an override of the compartmentalization protocol. After replacing the Divine Comedy on the shelf, the provost walked to the scotch bottle and poured himself half a glass. He had a very difficult decision to make. Chapter 52. Known as the Church of Dante, the sanctuary of Chiesa di Santa Margherita de' Cerchi is more of a chapel than a church. The tiny one-room house of worship is a popular destination for devotees of Dante who revere it as the sacred ground on which transpired 2 pivotal moments in the great poet's life. According to lore, it was here at this church, at the age of 9, that Dante first laid eyes on Beatrice Portinari, the woman with whom he fell in love at first sight, and for whom his heart ached his entire life. To Dante's great anguish, Beatrice married another man, and then died at the youthful age of 24. It was also in this church, some years later, that Dante married Gemma Donati, a woman who, even by the account of the great writer and poet Boccaccio, was a poor choice of wife for Dante. Despite having children, the couple showed little signs of affection for each other. And after Dante's exile, neither spouse seemed eager to see the other ever again. The love of Dante's life had always been and would always remain the departed Beatrice Portinari, whom Dante had scarcely known, and yet whose memory was so overpowering for him that her ghost became the muse that inspired his greatest works. Dante's celebrated volume of poetry, La Vita Nuova, overflows with flattering verses about the blessed Beatrice. More worshipful still, the Divine Comedy casts Beatrice as none other than the Savior who guides Dante through paradise. In both works, Dante longs for his unattainable lady. Nowadays, the Church of Dante has become a shrine for the broken-hearted who suffer from unrequited love. The tomb of young Beatrice herself is inside the church, and her simple sepulcher has become a pilgrimage destination for both Dante fans and heartsick lovers alike. This morning, as Langdon and Sienna wound their way through old Florence toward the church, the streets continued to narrow until they became little more than glorified pedestrian walkways. An occasional local car appeared, inching through the maze and forcing pedestrians to flatten themselves against the buildings as it passed. The church is just around the corner, Langdon told Sienna, hopeful that one of the tourists inside would be able to help them. He knew their chances of finding a good Samaritan were better now that Sienna had taken back her wig in exchange for Langdon's jacket, and both had reverted to their normal selves, transforming from rocker and skinhead to college professor and clean-cut young woman. Langdon was relieved once again to feel like himself. As they strode into an even tighter alleyway, the Via del Presto, Langdon scanned the various doorways. The entrance of the church was always tricky to locate because the building itself was very small, unadorned, and wedged tightly between two other buildings. One could easily walk past it without even noticing. Oddly, it was often easier to locate this church using not one's eyes, but one's ears. One of the peculiarities of La Chiesa di Santa Margherita dei Cerchi was that it hosted frequent concerts, and when no concert was scheduled, the church piped in recordings of those concerts so visitors could enjoy the music at any time. As anticipated, as they advanced down the alleyway, Langdon began to hear the thin strains of recorded music, which grew steadily louder, until he and Sienna were standing before the inconspicuous entrance. The only indication that this was indeed the correct location was a tiny sign, the antithesis of the bright red banner at the Museo Casa di Dante, that humbly announced that this was the church of Dante and Beatrice. When Langdon and Sienna stepped off the street into the dark confines of the church, the air grew cooler and the music grew louder. The interior was stark and simple, smaller than Langdon recalled. There was only a handful of tourists, mingling, writing in journals, sitting quietly in the pews enjoying the music, or examining the curious collection of artwork. With the exception of the Madonna-themed altarpiece by Neri de Bicci, almost all of the original art in this chapel had been replaced with contemporary pieces representing the two celebrities, Dante and Beatrice, the reasons most visitors sought out this tiny chapel. Most of the paintings depicted Dante's longing gaze during his famous first encounter with Beatrice, during which the poet, by his own account, instantly fell in love. The paintings were of widely varying quality, and most, to Langdon's taste, seemed kitschy and out of place. In one such rendering, Dante's iconic red cap with ear flaps looked like something Dante had stolen from Santa Claus. Nonetheless, the recurring theme of the poet's yearning gaze at his muse Beatrice left no doubt that this was a church of painful love, unfulfilled, unrequited, and unattained. Langdon turned instinctively to his left and gazed upon the modest tomb of Beatrice Portinari. This was the primary reason people visited this church, although not so much to see the tomb itself as to see the famous object that sat beside it, a wicker basket. This morning, as always, the simple wicker basket sat beside Beatrice's tomb. And this morning, as always, it was overflowing with folded slips of paper, each a handwritten letter from a visitor, written to Beatrice herself. Beatrice Portinari had become something of a patron saint of star-crossed lovers, and according to long-standing tradition, handwritten prayers to Beatrice could be deposited in the basket in the hope that she would intervene on the writer's behalf, perhaps inspiring someone to love them more, or helping them find their true love, or even giving them the strength to forget a love who had passed away. Langdon, many years ago, while in the throes of researching a book on art history, had paused in this church to leave a note in the basket, entreating Dante's muse not to grant him true love, but to shed on him some of the inspiration that had enabled Dante to write his massive tome. Sing in me, muse, and through me tell the story. The opening line of Homer's Odyssey had seemed a worthy supplication, and Langdon secretly believed his message had indeed sparked Beatrice's divine inspiration, for upon his return home, he had written the book with unusual ease.
Scusate!
Sienna's voice boomed suddenly.
Potete ascoltarmi tutti?
Everyone. Langdon spun to see Sienna loudly addressing the scattering of tourists, all of whom now glanced over at her, looking somewhat alarmed. Sienna smiled sweetly at everyone and asked in Italian if anyone happened to have a copy of Dante's Divine Comedy. After some strange looks and shakes of the head, she tried the question in English without any more success. An older woman who was sweeping the altar hissed sharply at Sienna and held up a finger to her lips for silence. Sienna turned back to Langdon and frowned as if to say, "Now what?" Sienna's calling all cars solicitation was not quite what Langdon had had in mind, but he had to admit he'd anticipated a better response than she'd received. On previous visits, Langdon had seen no shortage of tourists reading the Divine Comedy in this hallowed space, apparently enjoying a total immersion in the Dante experience. Not so today. Langdon set his sights on an elderly couple seated near the front of the church. The old man's bald head was dipped forward, chin to chest. Clearly, he was stealing a nap. The woman beside him seemed very much awake, with a pair of white earbud cables dangling from beneath her gray hair. A glimmer of promise, Langdon thought, making his way up the aisle until he was even with the couple. As Langdon had hoped, the woman's telltale white earbuds snaked down to an iPhone in her lap. Sensing she was being watched, she looked up and pulled the earbuds from her ears. Langdon had no idea what language the woman spoke, but the global proliferation of iPhones, iPads, and iPods had resulted in a vocabulary as universally understood as the male-female symbols that graced restrooms around the world. "iPhone?" Langdon asked, admiring her device. The old woman brightened at once, nodding proudly.
"Such a clever little toy,"
she whispered in a British accent.
"My son got it for me. I'm listening to my email. Can you believe it? Listening to my email? This little treasure actually reads it for me. With my old eyes, it's such a help."
"I have one too," Langdon said with a smile as he sat down beside her, careful not to wake up her sleeping husband. "But somehow I lost it last night."
"Oh, tragedy. Did you try the Find Your iPhone feature?" "My son says..."
"Stupid me, I never activated that feature." Langdon gave her a sheepish look and ventured hesitantly. "If it's not too much of an intrusion, would you mind terribly if I borrowed yours for just a moment? I need to look up something online. It would be a big help to me."
"Of course."
She pulled out the earbuds and thrust the device into his hands.
"No problem at all, poor dear."
Langdon thanked her and took the phone. While she prattled on beside him about how terrible she would feel if she lost her iPhone, Langdon pulled up Google's search window and pressed the microphone button. When the phone beeped once, Langdon articulated his search string. "Dante, Divine Comedy, Paradise, Canto 25. The woman looked amazed, apparently having yet to learn about this feature. As the search results began to materialize on the tiny screen, Langdon stole a quick glance back at Sienna, who was thumbing through some printed material near the basket of letters to Beatrice. Not far from where Sienna stood, a man in a necktie was kneeling in the shadows, praying intently, his head bowed low. Langdon couldn't see his face, but he felt a pang of sadness for the solitary man, who had probably lost his loved one and had come here for comfort. Langdon returned his focus to the iPhone, and within seconds was able to pull up a link to a digital offering of the Divine Comedy, freely accessible because it was in the public domain. When the page opened precisely to Canto 25, he had to admit he was impressed with the technology. "I've got to stop being such a snob about leather-bound books," he reminded himself. "E-books do have their moments." As the elderly woman looked on, showing a bit of concern and saying something about the high data rates for surfing the internet abroad, Langdon sensed that his window of opportunity would be brief, and he focused intently on the web page before him. The text was small, but the dim lighting in the chapel made the illuminated screen more legible. Langdon was pleased to see he had randomly stumbled into the Mandelbaum translation, a popular modern rendition by the late American professor Alan Mandelbaum. For his dazzling translation, Mandelbaum had received Italy's highest honor, the Presidential Cross of the Order of the Star of Italian Solidarity. While admittedly less overtly poetic than Longfellow's version, Mandelbaum's translation tended to be far more comprehensible. "Today I'll take clarity over poesy," Langdon thought, hoping to quickly spot in the text a reference to a specific location in Florence, the location where Ignazio hid the Dante death mask. The iPhone's tiny screen displayed only 6 lines of text at a time, and as Langdon began to read, he recalled the passage. In the opening of Canto 25, Dante referenced the Divine Comedy itself, the physical toll its writing had taken on him, and the aching hope that perhaps his heavenly poem could overcome the wolfish brutality of the exile that kept him from his fair Florence. Canto 25. If it should happen, if this sacred poem, this work so shared by heaven and by earth, that it has made me lean through these long years,
can ever overcome the cruelty that bars me from the fair fold where I slept, a lamb opposed to wolves that war on it. While the passage was a reminder that fair Florence was the home for which Dante longed while writing the Divine Comedy, Langdon saw no reference to any specific location in the city.
"What do you know about data charges?"
the woman interrupted, eyeing her iPhone with sudden concern.
"I just remembered my son told me to be careful about web surfing abroad."
Langdon assured her he would be only a minute and offered to reimburse her, but even so he sensed she would never let him read all 100 lines of Canto 25. He quickly scrolled down to the next 6 lines and continued reading. "By then, with other voice, with other fleece, I shall return as poet and put on, at my baptismal font, the laurel crown. For there I first found entry to that faith which makes souls welcome unto God. And then, for that faith, Peter garlanded my brow." Langdon loosely recalled this passage, too, an oblique reference to a political deal offered to Dante by his enemies. According to history, the wolves who banished Dante from Florence had told him he could return to the city only if he agreed to endure a public shaming, that of standing before an entire congregation, alone at his baptismal font, wearing only sackcloth as an admission of his guilt. In the passage Langdon had just read, Dante, having declined the deal, proclaims that if he ever returns to his baptismal font, he will be wearing not the sackcloth of a guilty man, but the laurel crown of a poet. Langdon raised his index finger to scroll farther, but the woman suddenly protested, holding out her hand for the iPhone, apparently having reconsidered her loan. Langdon barely heard her. In the split second before he had touched the screen, his eye had glossed over a line of text, seeing it a second time. "I shall return as poet and put on, at my baptismal font, the laurel crown." Langdon stared at the words, sensing that in his eagerness to find mention of a specific location, he'd almost missed a glowing prospect in the very opening lines. "At my baptismal font." Florence was home to one of the world's most celebrated baptismal fonts, which for more than 700 years had been used to purify and christen young Florentines, among them Dante Alighieri. Langdon immediately conjured an image of the building containing the font. It was a spectacular, octagonal edifice that in many ways was more heavenly than the Duomo itself. He now wondered if perhaps he'd read all he needed to read. Could this building be the place Ignazio was referring to? A ray of golden light blazed now in Langdon's mind as a beautiful image materialized, a spectacular set of bronze doors, radiant and glistening in the morning sun. "I know what Ignazio was trying to tell me." Any lingering doubts evaporated an instant later, when he realized that Ignazio Busoni was one of the only people in Florence who could possibly unlock those doors. "Robert, the gates are open to you, but you must hurry." Langdon handed the iPhone back to the old woman and thanked her profusely. He rushed over to Siena and whispered excitedly, "I know what gates Ignazio was talking about. The gates of paradise." Siena looked dubious. "The gates of paradise? Aren't those in heaven?" "Actually," Langdon said, giving her a wry smile and heading for the door, "if you know where to look, Florence is heaven."